Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome back to New Books in Economics, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Andrea Bernardi from Oxford Brookes University. Today, I'm with Dr. Simon Bowmaker from the New York University, and in particular from Stern School of Business, where Simon is professor of economics. And today, we are here to talk about his latest book. This was published in 2019 by the MIT Press, and it is a very intriguing book. The title is When the President Calls, Conversations with Economic Policymakers. Welcome, Simon. Thank you very much for your time. Can you tell us something about your current and past affiliations and maybe also about the origin of this very original book?
Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it very much. So I'm originally from England, where you're based right now. I'm from a place called Sunderland, which is the northeast of England. All my training in economics is from the UK. My undergraduate was University of Aberdeen, master's was Cambridge, PhD was University of St. Andrews in Scotland. And I've been living in America for almost 15 years now. I've been teaching at the Stern School of Business for 13 of those years. And I began this book quite some time ago, actually. I think it was about 7 or 8 years ago. The simple idea was, you know, what is it like as an economist to take your ideas to the very top of policymaking in the United States of America, you know, to test your skills, all of those things that you've learned over the years as an economist, you know, bring your ideas to the table, to the table in the White House, and to work with the president in trying to formulate economic policy. So that was the main motivation.
Let me say something about the book for those who will be listening. This is a quite large book, almost 700 pages. There are nine sections, one for each president from Nixon to Trump. So we are talking about 1969 to 2019, 50 years history of the United States. And there are 35 chapters, one for each economic advisor of those nine presidents. So maybe my first question will be, how did you manage to achieve such an impressive group of interviewees?
Yeah, that was, I have to say, that was a labor of love. I mean, you know, on the one hand, it was very, very hard work to get to quite a lot of these people because they're very, very busy. They're quite well known. I mean, some of them are, as you know, sort of household names. But I mean, the first thing I would always do was simply to cold call. I mean, I would send an email. I'd write a letter. I'd pick up the phone. You know, I literally would call them and see whether they'd be interested. I would speak with colleagues at work at NYU to see if they'd be willing to, you know, send an email to them or pick up the phone and speak to them on my behalf. But one thing that actually, as the project progressed, which was very useful, was the people in the book, my interviewees, were very, very, very generous with their time with me, and also were willing to help get some of the other people on board in the book. So, I mean, I'll give you a couple of examples. The first interview in the book is with George Shultz, who had a you know, incredible career in government in America, serving, you know, in various, you know, huge positions. And he obviously was hard to get in touch with in many ways. And John Taylor, who interviewed, spoke with him and arranged the interview. More recently, right at the end of the book, as you saw, I interviewed Kevin Hassett and Mick Mulvaney from the Trump administration. And, you know, very candidly, Arthur Laffer, who I interviewed. Laffer, as you know, worked with Reagan, also worked with Nixon as well. Arthur Laffer was very generous, very kind, and was willing to write to Kevin Hassett and Mick Mulvaney to ask if they'd be willing to be on board of the project. Also, Larry Summers, you know, that was hard work to get the interview. Jason Furman helped me with that. Nick Brady, Glenn Hubbard helped. Gene Sperling, Alan Kruger helped. So I'm really grateful to the interviewees, not just for giving their time to speak with me, but also helping get some of the other people on board.
And you start each chapter with a short note on the education of your interviewees. And you can easily notice that most of them studied in a relatively small group of top institutions, which is good, of course. But are there also any implications of these?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. I think that's a question which has been bandied around at the moment quite a lot in economics, because there's a view that economics these days is becoming quite an elitist discipline, that there's a so-called, you know, the top six universities or economics departments in America are dominating across a number of dimensions. And you could say, hey, well, look, there's a tendency that, you know, economics is becoming very insular. Now, if you translate that to policymaking, you would say, well, look, maybe the president is not really having the opportunity to hear from other good economists and to hear and receive other good views or good ideas. In other words, you know, he is not receiving perhaps a greater diversity of views as one might would like. I think that's potentially a controversial view. I mean, as you sort of hinted at the beginning there, I mean, there are clearly at the top six economics departments, there are some amazingly brilliant economists who kind of, you know, shape the discipline in a serious way. And, you know, it goes without saying that, you know, they might well be the first people that you'd bring to the table to speak to the president. But at the same time, I think many of us might be quite sympathetic to that view that, you know, there are other, you know, economists doing excellent work at other very good universities who don't get the same chance to speak with the president.
And besides the education, what else those 35 advisors have in common, if you could say?
Yeah, so something a little bit more abstract. I would say, look, they simply had a great passion for serving the country and a great passion, at least the straight pure economists I spoke with, the passion for the field, the passion for economics. I would say as well, something that they had in common was once they got to Washington, all of them experienced a very, very steep learning curve. What did I mean by that? I mean sort of, you know, they all had to grapple with the frustrations of dealing with the politics. The fact that, you know, politics more often than not trumps economics in Washington. They also had to grapple with the idea that often they would be confronting issues which, you know, were outside of their area of expertise. You know, I spoke with Eddie Lazier, who's at Stanford University, who served Bush 43. You know, he said, you can't just say to the president, I'm sorry, Mr. President, that's outside of my area of expertise. you know, you can't say that. You have to find an answer. And that was a commonality. You know, in academia, you know, sometimes you have 18 months, 2 years to find an answer to a question on a research project. When you're serving the president, that president needs to know the answer right now. You can't wait a week or a month or 2 months and work on a project. It has to be at that moment in time. So there's a lot of pressure to get the right answer as quickly as possible. And that was a commonality.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So the book is the history of those advisors, but also indirectly about those nine presidents. Who do you think was more docile or more refractory to the advices that they were receiving?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of answers to that. There's a more general answer, which is, at the end of the day, there are some presidents who are not quite interested in economic policy as they are in, for example, foreign policy. And there are two people who come to mind there. Number one is Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon was predominantly interested in foreign policy, and he was less interested in economic policy. And that came through very clearly in the book when I spoke with Paul Volcker, when I spoke with George Shultz, and also speaking with Art Laffer about that too. To a lesser extent, Bush 41 was also someone very interested in foreign policy, and to a lesser extent, you know, less interested in economic policy. But if you had to, you know, ask me, is there a particular president who didn't seem to listen as much as his advisor had wanted? I would say Jimmy Carter. So I had three advisors who I spoke with who worked with Jimmy Carter. So it was Charlie Shultz, Michael Blumenthal, and Stu Eisenstadt, and they all pretty much agreed that Jimmy Carter was quite autocratic and had very strong views that he stayed with. It was very, very difficult to kind of get Jimmy Carter to change his views no matter what they said. Some of them, you know, they suggested it had something to do with his engineering background, that he had a sort of an engineer's faith in statistics. He wanted everything to be comprehensive, you know, whether it was comprehensive energy reform or whatever it would be. He didn't quite understand the trade-offs that were inherent in economic policymaking. Try as the advisors did, they never could quite convince him of that. So I think Carter is my answer to your question.
And how did they happen to be called by those presidents? How does it work? Is it predominantly network chance, or maybe the special motivation of your interviewees that wanted to serve as advisors?
So there's probably maybe one or two got the call out of the blue. But I would say overall, most of those advisors had a good idea that at some stage they would get the call. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. Number one is, for example, you may have worked on the campaign of the president. If you work on the campaign, there's a relatively high probability that you will get that call to serve in the administration. I'll give you two examples. You know, Austin Goolsbee, who worked with President Obama on his campaign, obviously was called to the White House. Glenn Hubbard, who worked with Bush 43 on his campaign as his main economic advisor, again, he was called to the White House. Maybe you get to, you know, you're known to the president through your media work. I'll give you two examples. Murray Weidenbaum and Marty Feldstein, who advised President Reagan as the chairs of the Council of Economic Advisors, they'd done a lot of media work, a lot of writings in, you know, the Wall Street Journal. They'd done radio work, that testified in Congress, etc., and that caught the attention of President Reagan, and he called them to the White House. And of course, some of them, it simply worked in previous administrations, and they had a reputation for their good work. One person that comes to mind is someone who sadly passed away a few weeks ago. That's Paul O'Neill. Paul O'Neill was Secretary of the Treasury for Bush 43. He'd also worked for President Ford and had, you know, garnered a strong reputation at the OMB under Ford. So there's a bunch of different ways in which you get that call. And, you know, so, as I say, sometimes it might be out of the blue, but more often than not, they have an idea that they will get a call because they're known to the people who work for the president.
It makes sense. And now, in those 50 years that your book covers, can you tell us something about the way in which the relationship between the presidents and the advisors has changed or evolved in any specific direction? Because now we live in the so-called age of populism, where the relationship between the experts and the politicians is a difficult one, very tricky one. And this is true in economics, it's true in public health, it's true in many, many fields, for example, in dealing with climate change. So in this field, in economics, did you spot any evolution of this way of interacting between the advisors and the presidents?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say until the election of President Trump, you know, while economists have become more pervasive in Washington, their role and their relationship with the president has remained pretty much the same. I mean, what do I mean by that? They're bringing, you know, this very powerful, this very important, and I would argue as well, common framework to issues, and they're still holding a standard, you know, a high standard of evidence to the data. You know, over that 50 years, I mean, the political winds changed, but ultimately, what was the job of the economists when they were speaking with the advisors? It was to provide the president with what I'm calling, you know, unvarnished objective advice, to give the president the facts, to stop policy proposals, which, you know, might be, if you like, unhelpful. They might be costly, they might be inefficient. So I would say, broadly speaking, their role, their relationship as advisors with the president has remained roughly the same. That said, and this is quite an interesting idea, which was, you know, someone in the book pointed out to me, presidents now have access to iPads. So presidents now, you know, have a lot of information at their fingertips. There's information coming from one direction to another, which can actually cause some problems for advisors, because, you know, presidents might be, you know, reading something on the iPad, on the internet, getting information which contradicts what they've been presented by the advisors. You know, but so that's something which 40, 50 years ago, maybe you're thinking about working for Nixon, that would be less of an issue. But today, you know, we both know information is highly accessible, and, you know, that applies to the present as well.
There is a beautiful reference in the foreword by the director of London School of Economics, and she wrote that Harry Truman famously said that he wanted a 100 economist, because each one he sought advice from said on the one hand and on the other hand. So
that's right.
Is it a problem of economists, right, or is it normal that a scientist has this point of view?
I think as economists, we're always being criticized for, you know, we give an answer. We even, as you know, as economics professors, you know, we teach our students, you know, I'm teaching my MBA students, you know, like a firms and markets class. You know, we always begin by saying, you know, many answers to questions in economics are simply two words: it depends. Okay, so you say it depends. Now, a good economist knows what it depends upon. So I guess, you know, when you're working in Washington advising the president, it is true that things do depend, but the good economists in Washington are able to tell you what it depends upon. So that's why they're saying, on the one hand, something, and on the other hand, something else.
Well, instead of asking you about your future book, because you're just you've just ended a very large book, maybe can you tell us something about your previous three other books, just the topic, the title, so that our listeners might find them?
Yeah, I would love to do another book. I have to figure out what would be the next subject. Maybe I could do something, I don't know, European. So I've spent quite a lot of time in America speaking with, you know, American policymakers, and as I'll talk to you in a second, researchers in America and teachers in America. Maybe I could do some European. My last book was called The Art and Practice of Economics Research, Lessons from Leading Minds. So I interviewed 25 very prominent economists about quite simply how they went about their day-to-day work as researchers in economics. So that was a very productive project, which I enjoyed enormously. And I got to speak to some amazing economists. The book I did before that was called The Heart of Teaching Economics, Lessons from Leading Minds. And that was, again, it's just simply, you know, speaking with prominent economists about how they go about their daily lives as teachers of economics as opposed to researchers. So I guess where does the current book fit in? I mean, I'd done teaching, I then did research in economics, and then I thought it'd be a cool idea to think about how you do policy making in economics. What I didn't realize at the time was it was a lot harder to put the more recent book together. It just took much, much, much longer. Getting in touch with the right people, crafting the right questions. It was very, very hard. It was 50 years of economic history. And it was a far more ambitious project. I guess for the next one, maybe I could speak with people who have, you know, taken ideas in economics and applied them to, you know, solving, if you, you know, in quotes, real world problems, maybe someone like Paul Milgram who works on auctions, something like that. I think maybe that might be another book.
We look forward to reading your next book. In the meantime, congratulations for this book, which is, by the way, also enriched by amazing pictures of the economic advisors in action, in physical action, in a room with their presidents. Thank you very much, Simon, for your time. We spoke with Dr. Simon Bowmaker about his recent book, When the President Calls, Conversations with Economic Policymakers, published by MIT Press in 2019. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.